Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking your priority list for fall 2024. Our spotlight will take a look at potential strike on East and West Coast, or at Gulf Coast, sorry. Ag History Minute, we'll talk about the West history of the Western Bean Cutworm. Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events. We'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy.
It's hot outside.
Still hot. Still.
For two long weeks. I mean, there's an end in sight, potentially.
Sunday.
Sunday is the day that we make the transition, but dang. I mean, for the late corn, great, but for me personally, as a human being, I did not expect to be running my air conditioning in the month of September.
It's getting late now in September, too, to be...
Right, it was one thing early September, you'll have August-like weather, but to be, you know, late, almost October, and get this, it is crazy.
Yeah.
You know it's going to snow on Halloween again.
It's just going to turn.
Yep.
I don't know. So Nate and I were at a field day the other day, and we saw a woolly bear beelining it, and it was mostly brown, not a lot of red, and we were trying to remember what that means. And so now I'm going to have to look it up, because I haven't since then, but there's something about the weather that's supposed to...
The woolly bear wives' tale?
Yes, there is some woolly bear caterpillar, like, weather myth thing.
Like, are we officially in second summer of the Wisconsin seasons? Or is this, like...
Third summer this year?
Right.
So
it just seemed odd.
If the head end of the caterpillar is dark, the beginning of winter will be severe. The tail end is dark, the end of winter will be cold. So I don't know what that means when it was like almost all dark. Harsh winter, the more black, the more harsh.
So harsh winter.
So according to the woolly bear caterpillar that we saw in Sturgeon Bay on Wednesday, we're in for a harsh winter.
Harsh winter.
Or possibly moderate. This chart has one segment different of orange between moderate and harsh winter. So if you want to believe in the caterpillar weather predictor as a way of gauging this winter.
It's going to be worse than last year is what you're saying.
I mean, wouldn't literally any type of winter be worse than last year?
Fair. We were spreading manure in February because it wasn't frozen.
We had 2 weeks of winter last year, so anything beyond 2 weeks of winter is going to be more severe than, than last year. But
If you ask the Farmer's Almanac, what they say, it says we're in the area that says...
And they've been wrong for like the last how many years?
Oh, yeah. No.
But yes, please go on.
We're in the area that says cold, wet, and white.
Cold, wet, and white. Yeah. So it's going to be heavy, wet snow?
I don't know.
We don't need that.
If it's cold, it won't be heavy.
And I think just mean... And like if you go to Minnesota, North Dakota, Iowa, Missouri, it just says cold and average snowfall. So that's what they say.
All right.
Yeah, it's very vague though. like
does anyone have any chicken bones that we can throw or...
Not ready for snow.
Tarot cards we can start flipping to see.
Ever really ready for snow? I mean, especially not in, never till like post Thanksgiving.
Yeah, it's fair.
Well,
Christmas.
Even if we get snow in October, chances are it's not going to last.
Right.
That's the thing is, even in November, sometimes when we get like the deer hunting snows, they'll be there for maybe a few days. But it'll be interesting to see that. I feel like the trend has been wet Decembers the last few years as we just get more rain than snow in December. Then we'll get our cold snap in January. And from there, it's like, yeah, maybe we'll have snow, maybe not. I think we're back. Are we back in La Nina? Are we El Nino? It's changed so fast.
We were La Nina.
We were La Nina, then El Nino came in for this last year, but I think it's gone already, and we're back in La Nina. Yeah,
we're back.
We're back. And we're back with La Nina. Yo soy el niño. Spanish for the niño.
So it's going to be hotter in Nashville, though, Sunday. Oof.
Yeah.
You think there'll be more puking?
Possibly. There was enough. I had heard the center at first, and you were the one that told me that two other linemen puked, too,
yeah,
during the Packer game last.
So it was like heat stress puke? Yeah.
They said it was like the second hottest game ever in Lambeau.
Yeah, regular season game.
Regular season,
preseason,
yes.
But yes.
Well, yeah, preseason, right. In August, you can get hotter, but yeah.
But they're think preseason.
They're also not trying.
You're right. They're not. It's not the same.
They're not in a situation where the starting quarterback is injured and you're banking on a guy who's been there for less than a month.
And you're running a lot.
And you're running.
And running.
And running.
And running.
Running.
Just keep running, running, and running, running.
That is pretty cool when they run that much. The games only last like 2 hours and 58 minutes.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, you burn a lot of clock.
Yes.
Because what do they say? The Colts only had like 20, was it even 20 minutes of possession?
It was a big difference.
Yeah. It was a lot of Packer possession, not a lot of Colts.
And the Colts decided to be dumb and not run Jonathan Taylor, who was actually doing well.
Well, they seemed to stop him early, and then in the second half, Taylor broke off a couple big runs.
It was 40 and 11 minutes for the Pack and 19:50 minutes for...
Yeah, so not quite even 20 minutes.
They doubled them up for the Colts.
Did you see, since we're talking running and how actually pretty decent our running game was, did you hear that Aaron Jones is trying to steal the Lambeau Leap in Minnesota?
Like he's
calling it the Bank Vault.
The Bank Vault, because it's U.S. Bank Stadium.
I did not hear that.
It's a fun name. I'll give him that. And I still love Aaron Jones, but...
He's doing Lambeau Leaps in U.S. Bank Stadium and calling them the Bank Vaults.
They are 2-0, Matt.
So the bank is always open on Sunday.
Yeah.
His bank.
Yes.
He gets bank on Sunday. I'm trying to figure out if that's a fake 2-0 or a real 2-0.
It's fake. All these are fake. I mean, you don't know who's...
Well, think about...
Think how many are injured right now already.
Three-quarters of the 49ers apparently are.
Yeah, and they're playing the Rams, who everybody hurts on that team, too. So it's just... Yeah. I'm not saying they're fake, but you don't really know after two opponents what you have there. Sam Darnold as a quarterback is not... He's fine, but he's not as good as Kirk Cousins even.
And no, you think the regression to the mean over 16, 17 games is going to happen for him.
But, heck, they're ahead of us, so can't really talk. Did you watch us get beat by Bama?
I watched a little bit.
Yeah, but the Badgers got to play Alabama, which is cool. It's cool to see. Badgers play kind of a historic team like Alabama and kind of hang in there for a quarter and a little bit.
Yeah. As soon as Malusi fumbled, I'm like, that's...
Yeah.
He said Bama had 12 possessions and scored 6 touchdowns.
So we cut him in half.
Which I kind of was like, the way they were putting up points was like, I would have thought, like, I wouldn't have thought it would have been that. I would have thought it would have been like 6 of 8 or 7 of 9 or something. Like they only scored on half their possessions actually kind of surprised me. But the way they did it, like 17 seconds right before halftime, 2 passes and they're in the end zone. Like just
the so at halftime thing was so quick that you just felt. You felt like even if we scored, there's no way you're going to keep up at all. Like, we're not built for that at all.
No. That touchdown, right before the end of the half, he dropped a dime in there, and that guy was just like, it was perfect spot. Just boop.
Yeah, because my son was watching it, and we saw, I think the Badgers had a punt or something, and then I walked out of the room to do something else, and I came back in, and they scored. I'm like, well, what happened there? He's like, 2 passes, and they scored. It's like, crap.
Matt, what were those warships where you had those big ones And then all the little ones were able to sink the huge ones. I feel like we're the huge warships with our running game.
Like the Bismarck, when they sunk the Bismarck.
Yeah. We are the Bismarck, apparently. But.
The super battleships of World War II.
Yep.
Japan had a couple. The Yamamoto and the... I can't remember the other one. It was the Yamamoto and the... But yeah, the super battleship thing...
I think the
sounds great, but you know, they're not maneuverable. They're
slow.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're like all these cruisers around them just killing it. Yeah, we're just.
I think the problem with the Badgers is I think they've lost who they are.
What do you mean when you go from your identity as a running team to the new coach saying we're going to be an air raid offense, just pass it on people?
And then you can't?
You got to recruit those right players and change the whole thing.
Yeah.
And in a way, why go away from that identity when that's what you're known for and you have and you know you could recruit for that. So unless he can recruit, it's going to be tough. But it does seem like he's figuring that out, which is fine and takes some time. But, yes, we do not have an identity.
And they don't
We're like a big battleship that thinks we're going to try to be a cruiser, and we're not.
I'm willing to give him a year, because next year he's going to have his guys. His true, like, recruiting will be more next year.
With the portal and all that stuff, he could even quit. It doesn't take 4 years to change over a team anymore. You can do it a lot quicker with that, but... It's hard, too, to pull. Hopefully we can elite. It's still the bowl streak, right? We still have the longest streak of bowls, so if we can keep that up, that'd be great.
At this point, I don't know where they're going to find six wins to get there, though.
Sure.
Be playing in the toilet bowl.
Yeah.
At least the streak's on.
There's usually streaks in the toilet bowl.
Just got to keep the streak alive, Matt.
No Lysol for that toilet bowl. All right. Well, you guys ready to get into our topic today?
Yeah.
There was some hesitation there, Bill.
He was a chew.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, you came up with it, so you should be ready.
I'm ready.
All right. So, priority lists for this fall. I mean, it's probably a little bit bigger list this year than it's been, just because we've had a wild ride for really the last 2 years. Last year was dry for a good chunk of the year. We started out this year dry, then we got super wet, and now we're kind of back to dry. So, yeah.
I did not have on my bingo card. Like, if you would have asked me to make a bingo card in May, I did not have, we will break soil probes and not be able to get soil probes in the ground in September on my bingo card in May. Like, how did that change so quickly?
Flash drought.
Yep.
But it did. It happened so quick, and it happened...
Well, two weeks of high 80s temperatures.
Right, hot, and it didn't rain for those weeks, and all of a sudden you're that dry, and these crops are uptaking a lot of it, you know.
Right.
Drying things. We do definitely have moisture way down in places, but it's...
Can't get there.
Yeah, it's way down.
The top is... Very dry.
I did like your meme, Todd, of the the gas on the fire. You have to explain that.
No, so there's the meme where it's got a guy like pouring gas on a fire, and then you put something over the guy, something over the gas, and
something
on the fire. And the fire was the corn silage because we just were watching it burn up, and it wasn't. What's hard with this year's crop? Some areas look good, but I think it was somewhat fool's gold out there that it looked better than it really is. You know, it's still okay, but it's not tightening up maybe like guys thought, or yields aren't just quite as high as you maybe thought. So it was pretty tough to start. And then over the gas can was hot weather, just because that's the fuel on it, of just making it burn faster, harder, worse. And over the guy was it's a shallow roots and disease, because disease somewhat's coming in, but being dry, I think, helped that. It wasn't certain areas, certain varieties, certain fields are definitely getting hammered by it, but it isn't a total disaster from disease. But shallow roots definitely is pretty much everywhere. I mean, these roots did not have to go down. You know, they were just...
They didn't have to do anything.
No,
really.
They were a lazy teenager with a silver spoon this year. Yeah. Like, they got fed everything by their helicopter mom, and now they're trying to make them go work, and they're like, no, I just want to sit and play video games. What are you doing here?
Teenager.
Speaking
that's like
from experience.
My
am I the
you've got that. You've got that down pretty good. I don't know.
No, that's what I feel like this corn crop is right now. And then we're sitting here as the helicopter mom being like, what the heck? Like, you told me you were going to. Yeah, what are you doing all day? You told me
do your homework.
Yeah, you told me you're going to. Like, let's go. And yeah, it's just, it's still better though than we really. You got to go back to your expectations in May. In June of what we thought this crop was, I think in August we maybe got a little bit higher expectation of what it was going to do. And now we're starting to see it's okay, but it's not nothing sort of great. It's fine. And yeah, this weather's been, think of what this corn's gone through of, yeah, we're complaining about how hot it is, but it went through monsoons and yeah. Then through, you know, no rain. It's going like, well, what the heck? I don't know what to do here. So yeah, I think it's been quite a year and I wouldn't have expected that either.
Yeah. Those heavy winds we got about quite a month ago.
Yep.
That really exposed some of the worst shallow root fields. Like, I mean, BMRs had some bent BMR, which I expect because there's a reason it's BMR. It's lower lignin, so it's going to take that worse. But, yeah, there was some stuff that plants just went right down because there was no root system to hold it up.
And a lot of times, some of that will kind of slowly pop back, but...
Some of it's so short that even if it does kind of come back up, you're not going to get what you want out of it. And that's a rough conversation to have of like, yeah, no, it's coming back, but you're going to get the top of the plant. You're not going to get the cob or anything that's still in the ground. But anyway.
I think a high priority for this fall is compaction, right? Like,
yep,
we were dry, then we got really wet and probably just took all that pore space away, you know, and compacted that, you know, that soil structure just gone. So a big thing this fall is, I think, and I'm worried too, like, if we don't get a little bit more rain, I think they're talking maybe Sunday again now. But, like, if it's too dry, if we can't get the soil probe in the ground.
The too dry part, at least you know, that because you literally can't do it. But the too wet part's tricky because usually that fools you that.
Well, that's what I was worried about.
Right. That's what we were worried about the whole season.
A month and a half ago,
yeah.
Like, we can't even fix this compaction right. Because it's going to be like, you're going to make like a knife through butter, really,
right.
Is what you're going to do.
Right. And you're right. At least we're looking like, no, that won't be a problem.
Right.
That we'll be able to.
We'll just break the shanks off.
Right.
That might happen.
Right.
But I did have a grower has decent amount of no-till and cover crops, and they're doing some fracturing, and he was saying, like, it's doing an amazing job. Like,
right.
It's
yeah,
coming
that
up
situation
and going tonight. Back down. Like, it actually is. No, he's like, this is a perfect fall to do it.
That's good news. And what I would tell guys is, I mean, we see it with soil sampling, that if you can be right out there right after they harvest a field and be sampling it, usually that soil can probe easier. It's when it bakes in the sun on these hot days.
Yep. Yep.
And a lot of these we're going to have less days of baking sun, so that'll help. But that's what cooks it up. That's what makes it so hard.
Yep.
That could be one of your strategies, is to be following the chopper or the or as the combine leaves after bean harvest, you're actually doing tillage sooner, which I don't always love. I do usually like to give it a little period. Well, for us to get it soil sampled is nice. But, you know, it's hard to have the labor even to do that. It's going to be tough. So that probably may not work, but that is good that it is fracturing. I got a couple farms going with starting beans, and those fields too seem to be mellow. You know, our beans are usually more mellow than corn.
Right.
You know, it's just they just tend to be more mellow. You tend to not need the tillage, so you could maybe do an inline ripper if you got some deep compaction, or just leave them if you don't have a problem. But those would be fields too that should be okay, yet they seem mellow enough to hit. But yes, Bill, I think it's a good time to watch for compaction, get the probe out there, be looking. I know Jamie Patton and Kevin Jarrick were at a, I think they said it was Door County, somewhere at a field day with Soil Pit and looking at stuff. And what Kevin Jarrick had told me is that 2 feet, you know, they in the soil pit, they found a spot with some dye or something that Jamie had used.
Yeah, it was in Winnebago County.
Thank you. It was both the way it sounded. Both, and both filled up with water, which made me laugh because that's what I was giving Kevin. Pit, or did maybe pits? Not the Winnebago one, but the one somewhere else
the,
did.
The one in Winnebago was filled with water because it thunderstormed like right before.
Okay, yeah.
It was that high wind storm came through and just dumped.
Sure. So maybe you can maybe explain a little better, but literally had like 2 feet away. He had compaction versus not. So that's also going to be tricky this year of checking for it. It is, it's going to be depending on.
And it was a wheat field and it was a harvest track, was where the compaction was. Because you could see kind of that was somewhere where they'd either cut across the field or.
And at wheat harvest, we were.
It was wet enough yet. Yeah.
And then obviously. Testing, soil testing of many kinds, right? Like we can do our normal soil testing. We can do soil health testing if you want, if you're into the Haney thing. I mean, that's a good time to do it. And then soybean cyst nematode. We do this every fall. We talk about it. But it's just one thing, like, it's still September now. Think about it now.
Right.
So that when we get to November, you're like, oh, crap, I didn't do any SCN testing. Yep. Like, get it done now.
And yeah, these are one, too. Last year, I know we talked about trying to do it in, like, Sean Conley's idea of doing it in V6 corn, and then next year it'd be soybeans. So doing it basically in, like, June.
Yeah.
And whenever June comes, we're so busy with other. Yeah. You're not thinking about next year's soybean cyst.
No.
You're just not.
Well, this year, some of the corn wasn't even planted.
Yeah, well, right.
In June, so.
Right. And maybe we drown a bunch of the soybean cyst or who knows?
Yeah, system flush. We dried that it out, flushed it. Now dried it out again. Yeah. It'll.
So, but you're right, Bill. This is a good time to be rethinking about that and getting some tests done and sent in. So for next year's soybeans,
your strategy, Todd, is always like, okay, here's the cornfields we have. We're thinking of going to beans. Let's get them now.
Some of it out of beans. Some guys will do them. What I hate about that is if you're not going to beans again for a couple years. You don't know, but if you do take a bean field off and the yield was significantly poorer than anticipated, that'd be a good one to test to see, okay, do I got a soybean cyst problem here?
Are they really high?
Right.
Yeah.
So there's times, but if you're getting 50, 60, 70 bushel soybeans, and you're not going to go beans on beans, then no. But looking, like I said, I like to use them as a look ahead to know, okay, Do we have a problem here? Am I going to need a nematicide for the following year? Or is a variety that's resistant enough? Or do I not have a problem at all and I don't have to worry about it? And you're right, Bill, on soil testing, this is a great time with the...
Other than not being able to get a probe in the ground right now.
Well, correct. No, we'll figure that out.
Yeah.
Kind of. The
It'll rain enough. Eventually.
Someday. Yeah. Someday it'll rain again.
Yeah. But as farmers go out there, when you're looking at input prices and trying to maybe cut back on certain things, your soil test is a huge tool for that, of telling you what your fertility is at and looking at that and really basing it on, okay, can I go a little less on some P and K next year in certain spots? Where should I, where shouldn't I? And really help with making those decisions. And this is the time to get that done so that this winter we can make those decisions.
You may even consider, if you're a guy that does every 4 years, maybe this year with the way crop prices are and fertilizer really hasn't moved yet.
Like no.
You'd think it would. It should, because of how bad crop prices are, but it hasn't. And I just came through by Country Visions and they had like 30...
Rail cars
on the spur. They're pretty much gone now, but so you know they're filling.
Right.
Or maybe they took grain out. I don't know. But they were right by the fertilizer plant, so my assumption was they were bringing some fertilizer in. But maybe you bump up your soil test rotation and you go a little quicker this year because of that soil test is going to recoup. You can recoup that extra cost in that soil test more quickly than you can if you got to over apply on fertilizer then you can cut back on fertilizer, you can make that cost up. So that was my thought, was maybe some of these guys need to sample quicker. Maybe it's every other year now for a while, just to make sure we're not over-applying on fields that don't need it. And again, back to the soil here, dig roots if you can. If you can get it, get the shovel in the ground. Maybe you get a field off, Todd, and you're like, this just didn't yield very good, and I haven't had time to dig roots all summer. You can still go out there, and I did that with a soybean field a year ago. A guy called and was like, my beans just didn't yield, and we dug some roots, and sure enough, he vertical tilled that 2 inches when it was too wet, and right there was the line of where the soybean roots changed.
A little J-root there.
A lot of J-root.
I love your idea of doing bean roots. Because I think the corn roots I've dug, it was so wet, and they're not as they all look kind of the same.
Right.
They're just average looking, and they didn't, like, even some hatchet root or any of that, you go, like, well, yeah, I mudded it in because I had to.
Right.
And there's just less to tell that story, whereas in soybeans, we dig less soybean roots than we probably should, and that, like you say, if you can get that taproot thicker and deeper, that's how you get 60 bushel beans. So that might be a spot, too, that you if it comes off and the yield isn't there, look for nodulation, look for how the roots did, and really try to use that as a tool to do better the following year with any sort of tillage or less tillage or whatever you can do and learn from those. I think both are telling. It just seems that we do more in corn, so I like your idea of focusing on beans a little bit to help tell that story.
And I think you're going to find that, like anything else this year, it's going to be so variable. Like, I have dug some soybean roots in season, and nodulation was variable, even row to row. And compaction was variable, just even row to row based on that soil at planting time, and I think we're going to find more and more of that this year.
Yeah, summer's not necessarily that long, but it's easy to forget what happened early, especially when we're in a rush to plant in a year like this where we know the next rain's coming during planting time, and so you kind of forget, like, oh, yeah, I did that, until you do dig up roots or find something, and you're like, oh, yeah, this is where I worked it, planted it, rolled it the same day, and then we got like 6 inches of rain, which maybe helped, maybe didn't. So yeah, it's always kind of one of those things where it's not that long between planting and harvest, really, but we forget a lot in between.
You do forget a lot.
Yeah.
Part of it, I think you try to forget.
Sometimes,
the spring,
yeah,
was like, yeah, I had it was a co-op guy. He's like, oh, this will be your, you'll never forget. And I laughed. I said, this will be your, you'll try to forget.
Everyone will want to forget, yeah.
So, yes, and you do quickly.
You don't forget. Make a daily crop season journal, Matt, at the end of every day, write down what you did and
how you felt.
We probably do more than,
yeah. Just look at our scouting
like
notes.
Our scouting notes are kind of our journal of, like, oh, yeah.
I picture Matt like Doogie Howser style by that computer.
Yep, just clacking away on the keys of my old CRT monitor and IBM ThinkPad computer from 1987.
Yeah, just was like, I felt hot today, both.
I learned an important lesson. Outside. Soybeans float. We all float down here. But anyway.
So then next we're into cover crops and wheat, right? Like, we're now, like, let's go. Like, I had a guy call me yesterday, like, is it okay to plant wheat? I'm like, it's go time. Like,
yeah,
let's go.
This is from my favorite time to plant wheat is September 15th. Yeah,
right?
So and before October 1st. So,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And
any time.
And we just hope to get, you know,
moisture. The right rain.
So that's been the thing with some cover crops. Like, there was a window to plant cover crops that are growing and look great after wheat. And that now with silage being dry, you might put it in and it might sit for a little while here.
I am surprised. Todd, just driving west to Seymour one of your guys is putting it in, and I drove by there yesterday, and that wheat was up already.
Yeah.
That was planted like a week ago. Right. And that was on some prevent plant ground.
Right.
Kind of on the ledge, so.
Right. It could be like a drier field, but it'll be fine because it got in with the right moisture and, and like you say, Matt, even cover crops then planted then and wheat that do look pretty good.
Right. And that's not to say that you shouldn't plant them because having them in the ground and the rain, especially if it is on the drier side, it's not going to rot in dry soil.
There's always that comment of corn, like, would you rather have it in the bag or in the field, you know, in May?
Tell me what the soil conditions are.
Well, right. And cover crop, I would say in general, you'd always rather have it in the field than the bag. Yep. There's not a... Like, you might as well just plant it and wait and see. It's not...
Think about how dark it's getting already. Like...
Oh, yeah, right.
The daylight, daylight is not short. Yes. Yeah, it's
so
not long.
It needs to be in the field to capture as much good growing conditions as it can.
I have two responses to the corn question, Todd. Is, yes, it doesn't grow in the bag, but it also doesn't rot in the bag.
Right, right. But, okay, so that answers that. How often have you seen a cover crop rot in a field?
This time of year, no.
Right. Never, rarely. So I think that's a good point, man. I like that.
It really just depends how much mass you're going to get.
Right. Well, when you look at spring planting versus planting now, you're not waiting on soil temps.
Right. Right.
You might be waiting on moisture, but like Bill said, the moisture is going to come at some point. Even a heavy dew at night or something is going to provide some sort of moisture. So spring and fall are just two wholly different planting situations. Yes.
Yeah.
We got to get the poop out, though, Bill.
We do. That's my hardest. The hardest question I've had this fall is to we've got some triticale planted. The manure guy is up the farmer's butt to get over there and get manure on. And it's like, how quick do you get that? Like, if we plant our cover crop, what's our manure plan? And that's always been, right? Like, if no one wants to do cover crops, it's like, well, we got manure, so we're not going to do cover crops because it's just too confusing. Do we wait for 6 inches? We can't even wait that long. Is it 2 inches? Like, Matt, what have you seen, like, work?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's two ways to go about it. Is either, you know, a lot of times we try to get the cover crop in to get the most growing potential. But if you are lacking moisture, having the manure first, in that situation, at least you're planting into moisture then. I mean, you might have to wait a little bit. So this is one of those years where you could go either way. And having it up a little bit, it all depends on your rate, too. How heavy are you applying? What are you applying? Is it thick slurry or is it liquidy stuff off the top of the
pit? Right, or leachate or...
But, yeah, I think this is one of those years where either way is going to work. And, yeah, you probably want it up enough where it's not going to get smothered. I mean, I've seen it on wheat, like top spread manure on wheat, where wheat's only a couple inches and it survives.
Right.
So, especially with a cover crop, I'd be less nervous. You're still spending money on it. There's still value, and I don't want to discount the value of the cover crop. But adding that moisture, especially if it's dry and you're not sure it's going to come up, a light rate of manure isn't that bad.
And you're going to add nutrients to help that cover too, right? When we do get some rain, you're going to have some nutrients that are available right away.
And some of these guys with their wheat maybe did apply the manure first and then went out and planted because you have that bigger window. But yeah, I wouldn't be too afraid to have the manure as long as we're not smothering things or, you know, that's probably the biggest one, if it's surface applied and smothering, because even with the injection and stuff, if you've already planted, as long as you're not using some sort of really aggressive injector.
The 5-shank knives isn't going to help you none.
No.
No.
But yeah, it's a good combo. I like manure and cover crops all day long.
I think, too, we overthink who's first.
Right.
I got one farm and it's working great. They're chopping and then immediately behind they're spinning on cover crop and turbo tilling it in, and then they're gonna do low disturbance manure later, and it worked great last year. Worked great.
Yeah.
And then too, the manure takes longer. So then just getting cover crop out. So to me now I'd I'd rather do the cover crop first or do them both kind of at, you know, if you can at the same, you got some fields and maybe you're getting manure right away, but you can't.
Right. If you got to start somewhere, but right. plant covers in the others.
Other
and
places.
Then,
yeah.
Yep, and absolutely.
So no, it's that part of it is either one works. It just depends what you got time to do. And even that, I give a lot of farms credit of that's the hardest part with cover crop is finding the time. So like farm where you're chopping, all hands on deck on chopping.
Yeah. Right.
And now you got to find
you can't always have somebody on the drill.
Yeah, you got to find one of your guys to be planting the cover crop. And that's very hard. So the farms that are able to do that, you give them credit because that is hard
to work.
Great grandpa job.
What seems also to work well, Matt, is like a cash cropper that has a drill or something, right?
Sure.
That we're chopping and then he's not ready with beans yet or his corn's a long ways away. He's going to plant some wheat of his own, but then he can come in and
just keep rolling
get
on
the
yours.
Covers planted for you. But it is a good grandpa job. Like
instead of putting him in the tillage tool, you can put him in the drill.
Well, or like I said, get it spun on by the co-op and put them in a light turbo till type of something that's basically like a no-till drill.
Right. And we were even talking with one farm, Bill, about the potential that has a 360 rain hydro seeding. They're not there yet, but where you're doing manure and seeding at the same time. Or water and seeding at the same time. So.
We did get the cover planted and then
put it over the top. Right.
That was happening on Tuesday when I was there.
But I mean that potential of the company working on that technology and maybe being able to do it next year would be, it's that perfect middle ground of we're doing it all at the same time and getting yet more use out of the machine.
Don't forget lime. Right. Sometimes we maybe forget about lime. I know in our little bubble here, we don't have a lot going on.
But lime that's the problem with lime is there's just enough that I was just talking to another agronomist about it because it's even hard to manage from a crop planning side.
It's really hard
because, P and K, you kind of assess every year. But lime, like if you did it once 3 years ago, you can kind of check that box, but then you get a fresh soil test and then you got to readjust and check. And it just, the way we soil sample, the way we lime is difficult because it's not an every year like, oh yeah, we got to think about that and plan it out. And lime is just, it's been harder to get people just to spread it and do it and find people that have it. So it is somewhat of an afterthought. And on years like this, where fert is expensive, lime should be the first thought because it's your cheapest, best,
and the
quickest way
to get fert to work.
Right.
Yeah.
So I agree with you, Bill. This is the time to think about what is hard is a lot of time when we do things was the winter when we got fresh soil tests back and then you try to get it on in spring and it doesn't happen and because the window's tighter. And
then you forget about it.
Right,
again,
and then
right?
it just it's, is like, oh, yeah, whatever.
It's kind of like that soybean cyst nematode thing.
It is,
right? Like,
it is.
Oh, we should be doing it in June. Oh, well, don't have time in June. So just, I know in like Outagamie County, it's not like a huge thing, right, because of our soil types, but we travel enough around that.
Maybe a good way to think about it is consider pH at this time, just in general. So like out of Game County, we actually have the opposite problem where we have a lot of limestone-based soils with 7.5 to 8 pHs that maybe you think of your sulfur strategy or some sort of acidic thing to bring it down.
Yep.
So it's a good way to say this is a good time to adjust for pH if you can or if you need to or at least look at what you got to do with it.
All right, so there you go. There's some things to keep on that priority list, and like Todd said, check some boxes this fall as you're going through your harvest season. Now we'll move into our spotlight for today. So potential of a strike in the East Coast and Gulf Coast ports is out there. And so supply chain issues could continue to raise concerns, and it's now possible to see those further disruptions to the supply chain in the weeks and months ahead. Contract between the International Longshoremen's Association and the United States Maritime Alliance is set to expire September 30th, so 10 days from now. Negotiations between the parties have stalled, raising concerns about a possible strike on October 1st. Main points of contention are wage increase and limits on port automation. Negotiations broke down in July after the ILA learned that APM terminals and Maersk were using automated technology to process trucks without union labor. So 43% of U.S. imports are at risk. Could disrupt $3.7 billion worth of trade per day. The strike would impact retailers, manufacturers, farmers, all by delaying shipping and potentially shutting down production lines. So as of mid-September here, the two sides appear far apart. ILA has voted unanimously to support a strike if demands are not met, and there's call for both parties to return to the negotiating table to avoid the disruption. Parties could resume negotiations and potentially extend the current contract. President Biden's could use his influence to encourage negotiations or appoint a federal mediator. As a last resort, the president could also invoke the Taft-Hartley Act to implement an 80-day cooling-off period. Either way, we hope something happens to avoid major delays. Now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So today we're going to talk Western bean cutworm. So it's one of those pests that this year seemed to be trending up after a few years of really not seeing major movement by them. The western bean cutworm, or Striacosta albicosta, is native to North America. First described in 1887 from a collection of Arizona moths, was first mentioned as a pest of dry edible beans in Colorado in 1915, followed by corn in Idaho in 1957. Since its initial description, the range and distribution of the western bean cutworm have expanded first northward, then eastward. Range expansion between the 1940s and early 2000s was relatively slow. In the mid-1950s, it was described as affecting Idaho, Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, Utah, Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Alberta, and Mexico. It was then determined that Alberta report was a misidentification. Between 1970 and 1980, distribution was extended to include Oklahoma, South Dakota, and Wyoming. Western bean cutworm was only sporadically found in western Iowa before the year 2000, and the first economic damage in Iowa cornfields was reported in 2000. After 2000, the eastward expansion accelerated. Western bean cutworm adults have now been collected in 22 additional states and provinces since 1999, spreading from western Iowa to the east coast of the United States and Canada. As of 2017, economic damage has been reported in Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Michigan, Minnesota, New York, Wisconsin, Ontario, Quebec, and Nova Scotia. Hypotheses for the dramatic range expansion of western bean cutworm after 2000 include, but are not exclusive to, the widespread adoption of BT transgenic hybrids, leading to a reduction in either insecticide use or interspecies competition with other ear-feeding lepidoptera, such as European corn borer and corn earworm.
Interesting.
So, yeah. We might be getting too good at our jobs and making it easier for bringing the western beans.
They always say Mother Nature finds a way, right?
Yep. It's always something.
Good. Thank you, Matt. And thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It is really easy. All you need to do is search Tilth Talk Radio in Apple Podcasts. Or in an Android phone, you need to download an app like Podcast Addict. And there you can also listen on your computer or your smartphone browser. You just go to tilthag.com/podcasts. You can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now we'll move into our cool beans. That's corny and some current events. So cool beans.
Cool beans.
Cool beans.
Cool beans. Our cool beans this week. UW River Falls professors were given National Science Foundation grant. So two University of Wisconsin River Falls faculty have been awarded in National Science Foundation, or NSF, grant. This is to study carbon and nitrogen cycling in agricultural soils to understand their environmental movement and transformations. Bahara Hassanpour, Assistant Professor of Environmental Science and Environmental Engineering, was awarded the grant under the NSF's Empowering Broader Academic Capacity and Education, or EMBRACE, program. EMBRACE supports research and education at primarily undergraduate institutions. This funding allocates $400,000 to Hassanpour as principal investigator and to co-principal investigator Jill Coleman-Wasick, professor of environmental science. They are very excited that this grant is bringing research staff to the campus. It's also providing funding for undergraduate students to be involved in research. Hassanpour's research focuses on water quality in agricultural areas. The goal of her work is to understand the processes that impact nutrient cycling, in particular carbon and nitrogen, which are critical to maintaining the balance of life on Earth. So, interesting. Be curious to see what they find in that research. So we know carbon is a very big deal in modern agriculture, and how many different companies are looking to capitalize on carbon, so be something to watch. All right. That's Corny this week. Farmers are frustrated over the added duties to 2,4-D imports. So the Commerce Department has issued a preliminary order recommending countervailing duties on imports of 2,4-D from China and India, which account for roughly three-quarters of all 2,4-D herbicide sales in the U.S. The National Corn Growers Association and the American Soybean Association expressed frustration with the recently released recommendation by the U.S. Department of Commerce to impose those duties. On Tuesday, the U.S. Department of Commerce announced these duties from China and India, and as they continue an anti-dumping investigation into 2,4-D products from the two countries. From Chinese companies, the duties would range from a low of 3.1% for one company, but more than 27% for other Chinese exporters. For companies from India, the duties range from 3.28% to 5.29%. So statistics show that the U.S. imported 20.6 million pounds of 2,4-D from China last year, valued at $22.9 million, and 15.3 million pounds from India, which is valued at $21.6 million. So the U.S. uses about 46 million pounds of 2,4-D annually. So that accounts for 78% of all the 2,4-D sold last year coming from China and India. So yeah, hopefully they can get that figured out and find a way not to unnecessarily raise prices on that product. Now we'll wrap things up with our Field Good Friday. Cheese and non-fat dairy milk move to new multi-year highs. So milk prices continue to look better with each passing week. This is the time of year when buyers become more aggressive. They purchase for previously made contracts and increase inventory for anticipated upcoming demand. Their level of aggressiveness is based on demand and level of supply. Cheese inventory is below earlier levels. This is cause for concern, but added to that has been the continued year-over-year milk production declines. So what is interesting is the demand for barrel cheese. The barrel prices reached their highest price since November 5th, 2020. 1 year ago, barrel price was $1.82 compared to $2.48 on September 13th. Buyers were aggressive with the pricing, gaining 21 cents for the week. Barrel prices had three substantial gains this year that took place over short periods. One was April to mid-May, with a 67-cent increase. Another was in August, with a 38-cent increase, and the current increase of 38 cents happened over the last 2.5 weeks. So while it's uncertain whether the price is nearing a threshold or if it will have room to run higher, the recent buying interest indicates there's further upside potential. Block cheese has not followed suit but is in no way bearish, with the price reaching the highest level since May 24th of 2022. So good news for dairy farmers, I guess, that the demand is there and milk price may continue to move in a positive direction. Well, that'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So today we talked about your priority list for this fall, looking at compaction, soil testing, digging roots, and handling those cover crops. In our spotlight, we looked at the potential strike that may happen on East and Gulf ports. Ag History Minute, we talked about Western bean cutworm. Cool Beans this week was UW River Falls professors getting a National Science Foundation grant. That's Corny, it was potential added duties or taxes on 240 imports. And our Field Good Friday was that cheese and non-fat dry milk have moved to new multi-year highs. Thanks for listening, and as always, happy farming.